great honour and pleasure to have a chance to talk to Sir Richard Friend, the Cavendish Professor of Physics at Cambridge University. Richard, where and when were you born?
I was born in January 1953 in the Middlesex Hospital in London, where my father was a junior doctor. Mm-hmm. And I lived in and around London for the first 3.5 years of my life.
Which you don't remember very vividly, I don't suppose.
I have recollections of the house we lived in. I think it was in Radlett, and I can remember sitting in a pram looking at paint peeling off the wall and not really thinking it should be peeling off the wall. Probably not a tidy thought to have as a first memory. And then we moved to Staffordshire. My father got a job as a hospital consultant at the Stoke Hospitals, and we moved. By coincidence, my mother's family were from mid-Staffordshire, and we spent 2 years living with her brother, who farmed somewhere near Stafford. Mm. So a lot of my memories were the farmyard.
Oh, right.
Pigs, cows, and so on. There were still one or two horses there.
Mm.
And then when I was five, we moved to actually a large, rambling, rather very ugly old rectory, where I grew up, again in Staffordshire.
Mm. Sometimes people like to talk about further back in their family, grandparents. Did you have grandparents who you remember or influenced you?
Oh, I had only one grandparent who was alive more than a year or two after I was born. Mm. It was my father's mother, and she was not a scientist.
No.
So that was not a strong influence.
But basically you paint a picture of a middle class medical background, is that roughly right?
It was a middle class medical background, of course, in different ways. Mm. Both of my parents had had to struggle hard to get where they got to. They had lifted themselves beyond where life had probably seemed set to place them.
Mm.
So work ethic was very dominant at home.
Yes, that raises the question of your parents' temperament or character. I mean, your father was a very hard-working, distant figure, or what?
Well, he was hard-working, but actually very playful and approachable, and always amused to be confronted with something he wasn't expecting. So, though a figure of authority, not in a straightforward way, he was always happy to, when he felt like it, he was happy to engage in whatever sort of conversation we wanted to have with him.
Mm. And he read, your parents read to you and sort of stimulated you in various ways like that?
Oh, I'm sure I was given a wonderful middle class background, yes.
Did you have siblings or?
I have a brother who's a professor at Oxford.
Mm. Older or?
He's younger, he's a year younger. He's a transplant surgeon. He was a long time in Cambridge, but he moved to Oxford.
Mm.
So we were both doing what our parents wanted us to do, which was to work hard and achieve.
Mm. So you were encouraged and pushed on quite a bit by your parents in that usual way?
The sense that hard work was the way to improve one's lot and to get somewhere worthwhile was not lost on us.
What was your first school? And where did you go to school? In Stafford? Or?
My primary school was actually a small Catholic, basically girls' school that took small boys for a while until they became unbearably beastly, and then we were sent off somewhere.
Mm.
So I was taught by nuns at an early stage, but then I was packed off to boarding school. I was sent off at the age of 8 to an absolutely dreadful prep school.
You want to name this?
I don't suppose it's still going, at least I hope it isn't. So it was a place called the Old Hall at Wellington, now part of what is called Telford. And it was absolutely grim.
Mm. What usual things, beatings and torture, I mean, bullying.
It's the general beastliness of boarding schools at that time. I think in many ways it was a sort of peer group. We were encouraged not to be very nice to one another, and of course the sense of remoteness and dreadful food and freezing to death on sports fields and being prevented from using our brains usefully, all of that.
Did it not get good towards the end? That's usually what happens when you become a prefect or head boy or something.
Prep school, there was nothing good about it.
Nothing. Oh, that's interesting. Uniquely grim. Were your parents aware of your suffering, or you, in the usual way, keep it to yourself?
Well, they had, in many ways, probably had a harder time. My mother was orphaned by the time she was 11, and in fact, her happiest times were boarding school. She found more friendship because her home situation was very, very bleak. So I'm sure they didn't enjoy us being away. They were very close to us, but they somehow felt this was what had to happen, and there was a sense that we needed to be sent off to a proper public school, because that was seemed the right thing to do. And of course, one had to have Latin to get to a public school, and Latin meant going off to a prep school.
So your younger brother was there too.
He was there a year after me. Yes,
and that made it slightly more tolerable having at least one friend.
Well, I think one of the sort of beastnesses of boarding schools in at that time was that what ought to have been sort of natural sibling support and friendship was somehow not something one should be seen to be engaging in. So it didn't make a lot of difference, no.
Interesting. So are you, any signs of affection and warmth and so on, the sissy and naughty?
It was a sign, potentially a sign of weakness, I would say.
Well, we'll pass over that quickly then. Except I was talking to a mathematician recently, a very distinguished mathematician, and I said, when did you first show an interest in mathematics? And he said, well, my mother tells me that the only way she could keep me quiet when I was having a bath at the age of two was to give me sums. This was Peter Swinson there. Did you do any physics at this, or anything that might later lead you on into physics at this
school? The event that I can remember was my first Meccano set. That is a bit of a cliche, but Meccano was absolutely special.
At what age was that?
Oh, about five. So I eventually I assembled a wonderful Meccano set. I have a better collection of gears and cogs and pulleys. And I wasn't very interested in the bits to make the bodywork of whatever it was I was trying to make. It was assembling gearboxes and that sort of thing. Just that was happiness.
And that continued right through your school days, or at least your earlier school days, did it? I mean, you've got set 1A, set 1B, or whatever it, Meccano.
I worked my way through the sets, and beyond set 5, I just used to go and buy the pieces individually so I could get more gears and fewer ancillary bits, which weren't useful, in my view. and then, moving ahead a little, I think when I was 11, I got my first electronics set. I came in right at the start of transistors. I never managed to electrocute myself on thermionic valves, but transistors were, that was wonderful.
So you made radios
and water detectors and all the sorts of things you could make with a couple of transistors. I did that.
There's a strong tradition in Cambridge science, and British science, of sort of hands-on, fiddling around with your hands, and some of the great scientists I've interviewed have talked about their continuing making of gadgets up to Crick and Watson and beyond. I mean, is this something that's remained with you, an interest in using your hands in science, literally?
Using my hands in science, I think science has suffered. I think too much of it has become black box of necessity. A lot of electronic measurement is now too complex for you to be able to build your own amplifier and expect to perform as well as something that comes in a box. A lot of the business of getting data comes at the end of some relatively complex computerized data acquisition and data handling. So it's not gone away, but I don't think it's as immediate as the business of making and measuring.
And you could no longer make useful tools for your science now.
Well, I make useful tools at home. I'm a relatively enthusiastic woodworker, but but science, and of course I spend too much of my time writing grant proposals and not enough time at the lab bench.
Mm.
That's in the nature of.
Is there a lab bench now? Even
well, there are optical benches and there are electrical benches and there are clean rooms and yes, I'm heavily oriented towards experiment. I believe that most creativity happens through doing experiments, through observation.
Mm. Well, we'll come back to that. That's an interesting aside. Where did you go to school after this grimly place?
I went to Rugby at the age of 13. I'm not sure why I was sent to Rugby. There was no family connection at all with any of the major public schools. And I didn't win an entrance scholarship, but I got into the entrance scholars form. So I had a diet of classics and a tiny bit of science. And I was so-so at classics, and I didn't need to be taught the science, I just knew it, which irritated everybody else in the class enormously.
How did you know it?
I don't know. I didn't. I mean, it was sort of like being told stuff that I had known anyway.
You don't believe in reincarnation, do you?
I don't believe in reincarnation, but somehow it was sort of common sense, and that was the point that I think school became interesting. I was after the sort of formalism to somehow provide a structure around which I wanted to understand the real world, the physical world.
When you say you knew it, you knew biology, physics,
well,
chemistry,
biology
mathematics?
Was somehow escaped me, but physics, chemistry and the associated mathematics, which I suppose I thought that's where I wanted to be. I think this was the golden age of electronics and that somehow the magic of little bits of stuff that could transform small signals into large or radios work had got me. That was very interesting.
Were there any, sometimes a special teacher or teachers who influenced one? Was there anyone at Rugby in that way who?
Well, Rugby science in the 1960s was absolutely stunning. It was great paradox that the school rated its science as nothing, that the clever boys were discouraged from taking science A-levels. They were supposed to go very rapidly through classics. But the real strength of the school was the science. There were some very gifted physics and chemistry teachers. Several had Oxbridge PhDs and were in every sense excellent scientists whose knowledge of science was profound, and that came across. I mean, most of the rest of the school was completely uninterested in this, which was wonderful for me.
Can you remember any of their names?
Oh yes. There's a very famous physics teacher, Jeff Foxcroft, who was a national pioneer of the Nuffield teaching schemes, who just sort of knew electronics in a way that no one else did, so he was very special. There were actually one or two chemistry teachers who I remember very well. There's a wonderful sort of 19th century figure, George Daisley, who used to do extremely.
How do you spell his name?
Daisley. Yeah. I have to stop and think.
Like a daisy with an L-U-Y or something.
With a Z in it, yes. And he really went into the pyrotechnics. And felt that chemistry involved making things, and if they were dangerous, so much the better. So
those were the good old days when health and safety were a long way away.
Well, I had a special fume cupboard to do my own experiments, and he decided I needed to do cyanide preparations. So he drew a wonderful skull and crossbones in chalk on the fume cupboard glass, and for weeks we had these lethal concoctions which just left there. Meanwhile, other classes came by and used the main benches, and nothing happened to them. Of course, that's would lead to instant imprisonment these days. And then there was a young guy that actually just graduated from, I think, Cambridge, John Allen, who was really gave me an undergraduate education for A-level. It was wonderful.
You were lucky. What about other interests? We mentioned sports before we started talking. Did you play any games?
Well, I discovered after I left school that I didn't mind games, but the imposition of compulsory exercise was something I resisted at all costs. I went to enormous lengths to avoid playing organised sport, particularly rugby. It took a large fraction of my waking hours to find ruses to avoid. It was either compulsory performance or compulsory attendance to watch others, and both seemed to me to be completely unreasonable.
And what about music?
Music, I wish I could say I could play, but I never got round to learning how to play. I love listening, but I don't think I'm a musician. I can hear it, but I can't reproduce it.
And what music? I mean, you still listen to a lot of music.
Yes.
Live or...?
Live from time to time. Music of all sorts. I have a fairly large collection of classical CDs. But I suppose the going through the 60s, the collection of the great sort of musical events of one's childhood.
The Beatles, yeah.
All of that. I mean, yes, I mean, that's still very much part of what I like to listen to.
And jazz.
Jazz I've come to later. My wife enjoys jazz very much, and I think jazz is magical. I suppose it's a sort of cliche, but I mean, Miles Davis, I just listen to it, I never get tired of.
Does music, some thinkers find that music stimulates them in their thought, but either having heard something they then try and write or solve problems. Does it affect you, do you think, in your creative life at all, music?
I haven't stopped to think about that. I don't. It certainly affects me. In the right sort of music, it's almost like a sort of opiate, and it can put me into, it can calm me. I don't think I've correlated that with any moment of creativity.
Because one of the gurus in my field claimed, of course, which pleased me, that there were three true vocations: music, mathematics, and anthropology. But I've always interested in the association between music and mathematics as a result.
Well, I'm not a very good mathematician, and I don't think I'm a musician, so I think I probably failed that test.
Or even an anthropologist.
Well, I've never tested myself as that. Probably not. I wasn't going to fail at that too.
Or not attempt it. You mentioned your first school with a Catholic.
Yes.
Girls' school.
Yes.
That wasn't because your parents were Catholic.
No, they weren't, no.
Were they of any religious persuasion?
Well, my father was not, but his grandparents had arrived somewhere in Eastern Europe and were Jewish, but he had lapsed, his family had lapsed. My mother was solidly C of E, and certainly not Catholic.
What about yourself?
Well, I was pushed through the C of E world, which, to the extent that it matches with a sort of humanism approach to the need for what one could call a civilized society, content with it.
So, how would you classify yourself? Agnostic, atheist, or C of E, which some people would say was the same as both of those, but anyway.
Well, I hope I would characterize myself as tolerant. I'm completely allergic to anyone telling me what I should think on these sorts of matters, and I try very hard not to do anything which imposes my thinking on anybody else, because I would be not true to my principles if I were to do that. But the best of C of E is its tolerance.
What about the atheistic fundamentalists like Richard Dawkins? What is your view of them?
Richard Dawkins having a good go at a C of E bishop who one would regard as a pretty tolerant sort of person, it's almost like going to a blood sport, isn't it? It's wonderful. I I think it depends where you are. I think in the UK, in many parts of Europe, one can take a very relaxed view about the role of organized religion, of a Christian persuasion, and its impact on society. I'm shocked every time I go to the USA by the fundamentalism there, which I see as, I think fundamentalism is usually bad. And somehow, what Richard Dawkins has done is just to have focused. I mean, somehow you need to be, if you like, as extreme in the other way to be able to confront that. And I do admire him for what he's been able to do. His TV programs on, I think they were called The Root of All Evil, weren't they, used to be provocative.
Yes.
I thought were fascinating.
Mm.
So I admire what he does. I don't personally find it something that I sign up to in unreservedly.
Mm.
But I certainly give him full freedom to push his line.
Taking this just one stage further, and it's well known that some of your great physics predecessors, like Newton, were pretty religious people, and that Einstein, although he wasn't signed up to any particular religion, talked quite a lot about the sense of wonder and awe, which he saw as akin to a religious feeling. You, as a celebrated physicist, having looked deep into the mysteries of the physical universe, do you see on the other side of it anything more than wonder and awe? Or?
Well, let me make a side observation, and that is that I don't think that religious belief or lack of it correlates at all with ability as a physicist. I think they seem to involve different parts of our brains. Of course you can make the connections, and I think in general one wouldn't. It's hard for a physicist to be as profoundly atheistic as Richard Dawkins comes across as. I mean, perhaps I haven't spoken to him directly. I think sometimes you need to sort of know someone well to understand what they really think, as opposed to how they are projected. One is aware that with physics, that a lot of what we deal with appears to be certainty, that our models work quite astonishingly well. But we're aware that they're not reality. They're models which map reality insofar as we know them to work. And that when you stretch a bit beyond that, you have no secure foundation. And a lot of the contemplation that takes place in cosmology, which I don't do, is sort of drifts fairly quickly into what one could call theology.
Well, I was just thinking that as you were speaking, because someone I've recently interviewed is Neil Turok, and he's one of the protagonists now of parallel universes and theory and so on, and it sounds very religious to me that there is another reality just the other side of 30 to the minus, or a very small gap between us and another reality. It sounds very close to religion.
I think it's certainly the language that you would see in religion. I don't think the relationship is that straightforward, but certainly this sense that there's a lot we don't understand, we're sort of, it's if you like the paradox that some of what we have done and make use of works so well that we're confronted with the fact that it has no particular right to do that, or that we may be confronted with a different description one day. And it's that sort of sense of being both certain and uncertain that is probably good.
Yeah. Well, as Martin Rees was saying, we know very well what happened back to 1/1,000,000 of a second after the Big Bang, but before that we have no idea.
At the risk, I'm sure I should be controversial, but I've always chosen my science to be in areas where I can keep going back and measuring.
Mm-hmm.
And I have immense respect for what has been done in the field of cosmology.
Mm.
But all you can do there is observe. You can't design your experiment and do it.
Mm.
And there are many areas of science where our ability to get things right without being able to measure in many ways from many angles is rather limited.
Mm.
So I've avoided that problem, choosing to work in areas where I can be sure that observation is reliable.
Mm. One last question on that. I mean, Dawkins and others seem to think there is some clash between science and religion. In other words, if you are a real scientist, it's impossible to believe in religion. I think you implied when you talked about different parts of the brain that you don't see that, but you think that they are dealing with different kinds of questions. Is that right?
I suppose I've been lazy. I haven't really pushed myself. And if I did, I might find myself becoming an atheist.
Hmm.
One cannot deny that we seem to have a need to create something like a religion.
Hmm.
And to deny that would be to deny history. I don't like feeling that I need to abandon a sort of rationalist approach to knowing what has gone on in the past and what may happen in the future. But I don't know.
Hmm. That sounds more like an agnostic to me, but which is my preferred outcome. I don't know. Let's get back to rugby. You did specialise, although they wanted you to do other subjects. You specialised in science, and you presumably got lots of high A's in.
Yeah, I was pretty good at it. Yes,
yes, physics. And yes. How many A's did you do, just out of interest?
I did three A-levels when I was 16. Which you're not allowed to do these days.
No, and you got past them all well.
I did, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what did you do for the next 2 years?
As one was supposed to do in those days, I stayed on for a year beyond A-level to practice for the scholarship exam at for Cambridge, because getting scholars to Oxbridge was the sort of thing that the great public schools felt they had to be successful at.
Mm.
So I had an interesting year being taught in very small groups, taking my science, actually probably more chemistry than physics, a long way.
Mm. Why Cambridge? Or did you try Oxford?
Gosh, I think there was a discussion between my father and my housemaster, and I was told that I was applying to Trinity College, Cambridge.
Because of its well-known science traditions.
I'm not sure what the explanation was, but that was... That was what one did, and it wasn't a bad choice.
And that's where you went?
That's where I went, yes.
Mm. To read?
To read natural sciences.
Mm.
I wasn't sure whether I wanted to do chemistry or physics. It was one of the two. And it sort of emerged that it was physics during the first year as an undergraduate.
Mm.
I mean, it may not be true now, but physics was taught in a much more intellectually appealing way. It was structured around ideas rather than facts.
Mm.
And chemistry, the ideas were there, but they weren't presented so interestingly, more profoundly.
Who were the major figures, or any major figures, who, as teachers, lecturers, supervisors, influenced you as an undergraduate?
I think I was a pretty unruly undergraduate, and I think I took the view that I would learn things largely by myself. I enjoyed just the sort of elegance and carefully structured lectures that Gordon Squires gave in physics, actually, in the first year. Gordon is a wonderful teacher. He's a Director of Studies in physics at Trinity, of course, but a wonderful lecturer. I was intrigued by Brian Peppard, who I think most would say was not an easy person to learn from as an undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
He gave a very interesting lecture course, from which I think I thought I learned nothing at the time, but looking back, I learned a lot. And he did give me some supervisions in my final year, which felt rather terrifying. But he was very good in that he did stretch, not by going very deep or mathematically involved into problems, but just sort of testing why I believed something I'd been told in a lecture and getting me to think, and that was very enjoyable.
Mm. Was he then Cavendish Professor?
He was then Cavendish Professor. Mm. Yes.
Mm. Are there any of your friends of that particular period? Did your brother come up, by the way, as well?
My brother came and read medicine at Magdalen a year later. Yes.
A year later.
Mm. Yes.
Were there any of your friends from that, from the graduate period, who you stayed in contact with or have influenced you much? Or?
Well, it was a very good undergraduate crop at Trinity. Stephen Elliott and Michael Neuberger were exact contemporaries there, of course, both fellows at Trinity now.
Mm. Doing the same?
Well, Stephen moved to chemistry, and Michael, of course, is a very distinguished member of the laboratory for molecular biology. And he was a physicist for 2 years and then knew he was going to move to biochemistry. He probably had better advice than the rest of us as to what he should be doing.
Did you still have this sense, which intrigues me, that you knew a lot of this already and then you were just revisiting it or relearning, or were you moving up to a level where it was pretty new?
Ah, yes. Well, first, my first undergraduate year, I did very little work, and I knew the whole of first year chemistry, largely from what I'd been taught at Rugby, which is probably why I didn't want to carry on with chemistry. I didn't have to think very hard. The physics I've always found hard, and it was presented, I think I've always had to sort of stretch myself to understand it, and I did find it taught in the right way. It was designed to be stretching.
And it was.
And it was. Yes. I found it to be stretching, still do.
It's interesting you said you weren't much of a mathematician, or not a particularly good mathematician. I always assume that physicists, or in the case of Martin Rees, he said the same thing. He said he wasn't particularly good at mathematics. It always surprises me that, as an outsider, I thought the two, it was an essential tool, but I suppose it...
Well, you only have to have a tool that is good enough to solve the problem.
Mm. And a lot of the physics problems are not, don't require very...
There are many problems in physics which require deep and profound mathematics to solve, and those are not the ones I went off to try and solve.
Right. Were you what else were you doing particularly? Were you involved in any other studentish things, drama or rowing or...?
I've never rowed. I never saw the point. It struck me as a curiously non-cerebral thing to do, apparently, academically oriented university. And being an undergraduate in the early 70s was a time to be fairly left-wing and revolting. And there were just the general buzz of alternative activities that... Nothing very organised, nothing that would have happened within a society. So I had a pretty wild bunch of friends. I mean, it seemed to be the important thing to me, just to sort of enjoy the end of capitalism or whatever.
And the Vietnam War, the end of the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War somehow never seemed to matter very much. It seemed to be an American problem rather than a British problem.
That's interesting. As I was at King's, I came to King's at that time, and there were a number of people in King's, like Martin Bernal and others, who were quite involved with it, which you're probably right, most of the fellows weren't. so much. And King's was pretty left wing college as well. Sounds as if you're going to automatically decide to go on and do a PhD. Is that what you did? Or?
Yes, I didn't have any better ideas.
Mm. And you went on to do it on what subject?
I ended up doing it in physics, but very much where physics meets chemistry.
Mm.
I joined a group of Abe Yoffe, who was leading a group that actually migrated from physical chemistry. It was the group that Bowden, who was dead before I arrived, had brought to Cambridge and in surface and friction. And I think under Neville Mott, it had moved across to be an activity within the Cavendish. But it was always regarded as not
quite. It wasn't colloid science.
So it wasn't colloid, I'm incorrect in that. It was friction and lubrication, superficial physics, I think it was called, without any sense of irony. what was interesting then was that these were some of the materials that were of interest, actually, because they make good lubricants, things like molybdenum disulfide, were appreciated as materials that were interesting as semiconductors. And the sort of thought that materials you might make transistors out of could themselves be chemically complex, I just found intriguing. That sort of sense that these were two worlds that weren't necessarily seen as having any useful conjunction. Seemed a nice place to explore.
Mm. So the thesis was about semiconductors, was it? Or
the thesis was about rather obscure, I would now call it obscure, at the time I thought it was vital, property of metals when the electrons of a metal are constrained, so that rather than travelling around in all three dimensions, they're constrained either to travel just within a layer or along a chain. And in those circumstances, they're not stable. They naturally distort, and they do that usually at a low temperature. Somewhere down towards liquid helium temperatures, they reorganise the crystal lattice to put in a distortion which switches them across to semiconducting. And that sort of sense of the coupling between structure and electronic structure was interesting. I was looking at that in Cambridge on some two-dimensional metals, and then ended up being sent to a wonderful group in Paris, actually my second year as a research student, and specifically to do some experiments where we could measure electrical properties on samples subjected to enormously high hydrostatic pressures. You know, pressure is a sort of physicist's alternative to chemical variation. It's a way of just modifying properties and switching the propensity of these materials to distort from metal to become semiconductor, and that was very productive, and it caused me to decide to really finish my PhD in Paris. So I ended up spending a postdoc year before I had even contemplated writing my PhD. I'd been elected to a research fellowship at St. John's in 1977, and that's when I switched away from the world of inorganic materials to working with molecules, carbon-based conductors, because that was the main research line in Paris. And that has turned out to be a theme that has kept me going in various ways since then.
Who was your supervisor? I mean, was it a Cambridge person?
My Cambridge supervisor is Abe Yoffe. And then in Paris, there was Denis Jerome, who has a lot of significant discoveries to his name.
When you became a postdoc, did you teach at all, or were you just doing research?
As a grad student, I was doing my supervising to earn a bit of money. That's sort of part of the rite of passage, isn't it? learning how to do a bit of teaching.
Hmm.
I mean, teaching I've always been frightened of. I always find a group of undergraduates much more terrifying than a thousand or so of my peers at some international conference.
It is a, it's a variant of what I call Parkinson's law, that small decisions are much more difficult than big decisions. To spend £1 million is much easier than spending £10. It's the same I found with teaching. I can get terrified by one first year undergraduate, and then when I have to lecture hundreds of people, it's very simple.
Oh, I think so. Yes.
This is why I understand that people like Bush have an easy job. I mean, running in the United States is far easier than driving a bus into Cambridge.
Well, he doesn't have to do it all by himself, fortunately.
That's also the case. There's something about the face-to-face contact with people which is difficult. Have you done much teaching? I mean, this is anticipating, but much teaching after you became presumably a university lecturer and media?
I've done my bit. I've done at least my share of teaching and examining. I've sort of liked it. I wouldn't say I'm a born teacher.
Mm.
My ratings from the undergraduates are not wonderful, but they're not disastrous. I pass.
Mm. That's for lectures or for...?
For lectures. And supervisions, I've done all that. I've done all the college stuff. I did 4 years as a college tutor in St John's, from 87 to 93.
And you quite like lecturing?
No, not 93, 90, 91, yes.
Lectures you quite enjoy?
Giving lectures.
Mm.
Yes, I'm never as organised as I should be. They tend to get done last minute.
Mm.
And sometimes I think they're good.
And sometimes you hope the audience think they're good too. Some people think that there's a kind of tension between teaching and research, but I was surprised to find that a book I hadn't read for many years, I suppose, Cardinal Newman, and his The Idea of a University, said that universities were just purely for teaching. I mean, that was the only purpose of a university, whereas research should be done in things like the Royal Institution, the British Academy. You should have a complete separation. And as you know, some universities have been forced into this to keep up their ratings.
Well, the false assumption when we usually have this conversation in Cambridge is that when we say teaching, we mean undergraduates.
Mm.
And of course, for every two undergraduates, we have one graduate student here. And actually, we give scant attention to what we offer our graduate students.
Mm.
A lot of the time, they don't need it.
Mm.
But we have failed to understand that this university has changed.
Mm.
And I would say that the business of graduate teaching is very interesting. I mean, it's not the same as undergraduate teaching in experimental science. It's perhaps, in some sense, aspects of it are like an apprenticeship. It's learning how to use some tools, but then stopping short of telling or instructing a student what to do with the tools once acquired.
Well, that used to be, I mean, the gap has grown bigger, that used to be the concept of undergraduate teaching too, that you're transmitting tools and methods as well as content.
The difficulty with physical sciences is that the subjects are hierarchical. Things have to be taught. There's just a lot of stuff that has to be known. You have to do it all, and it is dry. I can quite reasonably like to teach efficiently, which means that we teach, if you like, the consolidated understanding of a field, rather than the pieces which were used to construct the field in the first instance. So the business of sort of rediscovering how you deal with incomplete information or conflicting models happens right at the end of the undergraduate period, and of course is absolutely what you need to learn about as you head off into time as a PhD student.
Mm.
But to go back, yes, I don't think we should be allowed to escape in all forms of contribution to the university. I think a sort of separation into those that have seem to be lovelier tasks and those who are £2,000 to have to do them would be disastrous. Mm. It would be quite wrong.
Even the mixture of some administrative or other duties. A lot of people I've met, particularly from centralised universities, who've come here and said, why can't we let hire some professional administrators and then get on with our research? But I've always valued the fact that we run our lives considerably ourselves. But I don't know what you feel, whether you could do with less committees. And
when you ask me this question at a good time, I'm in my fourth year as head of the School of Physical Sciences.
Are you? Oh, I'm amazed you're here and so calm. And
which is interesting. I mean, I have a very firm view that we need, well, academic leadership, it could be much misinterpreted.
Hmm.
That I have no idea what the right things to do are, but I suppose because I still do it, I hope I have more sympathy with the situation that others find themselves in, or that I'm appropriately not dogmatic about what is bound to work and what is bound not to work. And I do think that we should be seen to be led by people who take time out from doing the job rather than creating a cadre of professional administrators. And we are a bottom-up organisation for all the right reasons. The bottom-up works if there is a sort of ecosystem which has been designed from the top down, which may not be prescriptive, but has been skillfully designed to allow bottom-up to flourish.
Mm.
And I think the challenge of arranging that the infrastructure, the broad direction of the institution can allow that is really difficult. I don't believe that people who are outside the business of research and teaching understand that.
That's very well expressed and very interesting. I'm writing a history analysis of how Cambridge works over the years. That's how I see it too. And I think on the whole, though I haven't got much comparative experience, and I was going to ask you about that, it does seem to work rather well. Whereas having watched top-down systems and some of the centralised London universities and guessed at what's happening in America, they have something very different.
Looking back, I took for granted that I had freedoms in Cambridge, which I wouldn't have had anywhere else. As an assistant lecturer, I had complete autonomy. I was never constrained for space. I always managed to have the resource I wanted for my research. I was given access to very bright research students. They weren't sort of scooped off and given to the grandees. And as I climbed up the career ladder here, I realised that to colleagues outside Cambridge and, of course, outside the UK, who of course don't understand our strange titles for our various tiers of academic job, it made no difference. I was just as able to do my work as assistant lecturer as I am as Cavendish professor. It doesn't make any difference. And it's good that Cambridge can do that.
Excellent. I'm delighted you put it on record, because that's been my experience too. There's been no real change.
I have more to do now. Somehow I'm loaded with more responsibility. In some ways it's harder.
Mm.
But I hope it's still the case that no matter what your rank is, the freedom to do what you think you should do is there.
Let me, since you're so interesting on this, I'll ask you two other things which I've been concerned with. One is the matter of trust.
Mm.
Many academic or intellectual institutions around the world are based on mistrust.
Mm.
That if you discover something interesting, you keep it from people.
Mm.
Private property and knowledge and so on. And that if you ask people their views on things, you have to allow for the fact that they'll probably try and deceive you, unless there's a very good reason for them telling you the truth. This is a proposition from anthropology, it's observations in many societies.
Mm.
But my experience is that Cambridge there is a good deal of trust that you have to assume that people are going to tell you most of the truth when you ask them questions, and that they will not hold back if you ask them the right questions. I don't know what your experience has been.
You've confronted me with something that I hadn't thought about in those terms. So I don't have a prepared answer.
Good.
I think it's a bit of both.
Mm.
I think it is. A lot of it depends on scale. The Cavendish is a little bit too large. It has. There is some tribalism there. I mean, it's a little deep rooted. I mean, long before I arrived there, so that there is considerable loyalty within a research group, but some rivalry between research groups, which doesn't actually serve us well. We don't necessarily share resources as well as we should. And maybe this is something which is well understood, that there's a group size within which it is possible to work on a basis of trust, but beyond that, it just becomes a bit too remote, and therefore it sort of fractionates into different pieces. I
think that is, I mean, Parkinson's law of committees is that once they reach 16 and above, they become no longer face-to-face committees, they become different. Their chemistry changes, and it's clearly the case with organisations as well. This college, like King's, is probably too big to have proper communal feeling between the members. Once you get about 50 or 60 fellows, it's like that.
The research groups that I'm part of at the moment in the Cavendish, we are hover around 50 people. There are two other university teaching officers, Neil Greenham and Henning Seringhaus, and we have a significant number of students and postdocs. That is absolutely the largest it can be. And beyond that, it can't function as a cohesive group where, members of the group would expect to find companionship, friendship, social outlets, as well as work. And it's, I think, for experimental science is a very it's a very people-centric activity. There's a lot of sharing of know-how, a lot of helping of one another to get an experiment going, a lot of passing on of techniques from one to another, and you have to engineer that's done well. Well, I have been told by usually non-Americans who've been at US universities that they can't quite believe it, that within the group, you know, everyone tells everyone what they're doing, because back in that group in the US, they were in competition with one another, and someone's success would mean that they would be more likely to get the job because they get a better letter from their supervisor.
Well, this is what I'd heard of.
I've heard that second hand. So I have to be careful that that's how had it really relayed to me.
Have you ever taught in an American university? Or?
I have taught when I was on sabbatical at Santa Barbara in California 20 years ago. I taught a sophomore course, Maxwell's Equations. I was just allowed to use calculus, but only just.
Were you ever tempted? You must have had many offers from America.
Yes, I've had lots of offers from America.
Are you never tempted to go there?
Not really.
Why? Push or pull?
I don't think I can give a simple answer. I think the bit that I can't cope with is that Americans actually are at work all the time. If you want to get hold of a professor in an American university, you phone them during working hours and they pick the phone up. I find that really scary. I mean, I think I'm told I work a lot, but I don't like to be at my desk all the time. And work is, you know, it's a more complex business. And I don't know, there's a sort of, it's an awfully serious business there. I mean, this may sound ridiculous because I do take my work seriously, but I like to take it seriously in a context where I can appear to be not taking it seriously. It's the sort of ambivalence of my relationship with my job that I like to be able to amuse myself with, and I don't think I can do that in the US.
Well, I think D.H. Lawrence had some famous line, which my wife often quotes to me about, you know, if work is not fun, it's not worth doing.
Yes.
Or words to that effect.
Yes.
There's got to be a playful side to it.
I think it's not quite taking myself seriously.
Mm.
But, I mean, others, if they get a chance to listen to me saying this, will probably to switch off in disgust or fall about laughing, because they may regard me as rather driven.
No, this is very British. they'll just say, oh, that's very English. So you never decided to go to America. And the other thing which you alluded to, and I was just going to ask you about, well, actually, on the trust matter, you're in a very different situation from the arts and humanities and social science. Nothing we do is of any value in a capitalist society in terms of financial gains. And therefore we can squander our small advances of knowledge in the knowledge that no student can take it away and do anything with it, or anyone else. In your case, you're in a world where there's a lot of money floating around. Does that not lead to firewalls and trust? And
well, of course, yeah. I have been involved in work which has led to what have turned out to be very valuable inventions, which we've protected by filing patents. My sort of the view that I've come to, I don't think I necessarily had it at the time, is that if you try to avoid putting yourself in a compromised position, you switch off opportunities. So there's nothing wrong in a conflict of interests, so long as you're open about it and make sure that everybody who's in some way associated with that conflict knows what the issues are and knows what the resolution is. So any structure or set of rules that a university creates to sort of manage away that problem, I think, is deluding itself. I think you need to just allow things to go where they're going to go, and then be careful to manage it correctly. So yes, I've been involved in, I've done a lot of patent filing. Out of that, I've been involved in forming a couple of companies. No one in the research group has ever been denied information about experimental results. We had an extremely important discovery in 1989 when we discovered we could make little diodes made with plastic materials, semiconducting plastics, which we were working on, which we could get to light up by putting a voltage across them. It's turned out to be very important. We have a fundamental patent that controls the use of that, of any of those materials, for anything that emits light when electrically excited. But there were dozens of people in the Cavendish knew about that before the patent was filed. We made no effort to keep it under wraps, because we trusted that it's what people should be aware of what was going on. Why would they tell anybody outside?
Though, okay, one of the Aaron Klug's stories was how he had invented something to do with scanning. I think it was three-dimensional scanning. And it was patented by an American scientist who then got the Nobel Prize. He wasn't worried about the patent. It was the fact that by patenting it, this man scooped his second Nobel Prize from him. So that presumably occasionally could happen. But
oh, well, the unpleasantness of presumed deliberations over who get prizes and not or not is something which can spoil a happy career, I'm sure. I think you have to sort of look,
get on with things.
But the real world is there, and a lot of science is very dependent on the real world. We need technology. Technology has usually been it's been the biggest engine of discovery, just being able to make things and measure things which were previously impossible to tackle, just keeps on throwing up how bizarre and unexpected the world turns out to be. So having a nose for where you can get, you know, use tools to go exploring things which have not been regarded as worth looking at before is a surefire way of getting something good, I would say. And that does take you into the world of industry, or can do.
Mm.
I just see that as fair game.
Mm. It's interesting. I mean, Martin Rees said that astronomy was largely driven by technology and the changes in the measurement techniques.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Yes.
And that's true with you too.
It is true. And one of the messages that I get put on the spot because our companies have turned out to be, as startup companies go, relatively significant, and I'm sort of constantly sort of asked to pronounce words of wisdom on the subject, which is probably very unwise. But the one that I will sign up to is that although I took a big risk taking time out along with others to get the first company, Cambridge Display Technology, going, and I'd somehow presumed that the company would head off at right angles to my line of university work. It didn't. It has continued to sustain, if you like, provide an engineering base, which has fed back into the university group. So here is the paradox. Because we set up a company, we didn't have to do the engineering in the Cavendish. We could just do the science.
Further question about the intellectual culture. It's a theory in anthropology that in almost all situations there's a competition, which means that people feel if someone else does well, you do badly. I mean, in mathematics it's zero-sum games, in anthropology it's limited good, and in India it's the frogs in the well syndrome. And in a lot of universities I've visited, they said this is the kind of competition within the group, and so, and this is what happened at school, obviously your preparatory school, the jealousy and competition. But as far as I see, Cambridge seems to have an expensive enough system to, on the whole, mean that you feel that when your friends do well, you do well, that there's a mirroring. I don't know whether that's your impression within your lab.
I hope it is. I think it's possibly naturally something which should, where the overall benefit is more obvious, where there is a sort of need to work together collectively. So it's sort of self-evident to, I would say, most members of the research group that to be able to turn to other people who are doing extremely well with what they do and learning how to do it from them is far better than them not being there and not being able to call on that expertise. And most of the time see that the opportunities for them when they've got their PhDs are very good, and that they're probably not in competition with anybody else for anything very particular. I think it's all right, but you're right, behind that there is a sense of there being a zero-sum game, and I suppose if you're after one of very few academic positions that might be going around in the UK, then you might be rather more concerned about these things. But of course, in general, research groups in Cambridge are very international, and the different stages that the members of the group might be playing towards are very different, isn't it? They don't need to be in competition.
Yes, I think that openness to the world in general helps. I mean, a lot of smaller universities in rather remote places, the pool is very small, and if you're not doing well in it or someone else does well in it, it affects you rather more than Cambridge, where you can move out.
Well, Cambridge physics has always been very international. The international mix has changed with time, and we've benefited through membership of the EU, done very well from that. I'm sure in previous times we did very well through the Commonwealth and before that the Empire.
Mm.
But it's never been a very British-only sort of place.
Mm. Mm. You talked about collaboration within the group. Certainly in my subject and in a lot of the arts and humanities, the people have commented on the advantages or disadvantages of having a collegiate structure alongside a departmental and faculty structure in terms of collaboration, or at least exchanging ideas with people in neighbouring fields. Do you think the college, this is another way of saying, do you think the college system helps in your subject in any way?
Not much.
Well, you're out in West Cambridge, you see.
I have had some very good contacts through my membership of St John's.
Mm.
I think the division between High Table and the rest is absolutely outdated and stupid. I would far rather feel that if I turn up for lunch somewhere, I am just as likely to be sitting next to a graduate student as a colleague who probably wants to bend my ear about something rather trivial.
Mm. Well, we have abolished it in King's, you'll be glad to hear, at lunch anyway.
I am aware that not all colleges are as backward as some that I've been associated with, and I have to say I don't find much time to do things in college now.
Mm. Is the fact that the sciences have moved well out of the centre of Cambridge, has that had much effect, do you think? Because when the old Cavendish was there, the college and the Cavendish were very close.
Well, the new Cavendish, the building, of course, is absolutely ghastly and it's already falling down. But it does have a good canteen. It does, it suffers from not having the subsidy that college kitchens have through stealing money off students with so-called kitchen fixed charges. So there is a pricing problem, but it's pretty good and it's far enough away that a lot of people will stay over for lunch in the departmental canteen. And that's usually where I have lunch, and I do get to have the sort of informal conversations with whoever that way. And I think you need to have that combination of the sort of formal relationship and the informal, because science is not about, it's not a military sort of command structure. The ideas and observations come from everybody, and you need to have broken, and to have a sense of sort of social equality. A sort of social ease amongst everyone in the group, so that no one is too timid to come forward with an idea.
Hmm. Does it go on into the evenings at all, the social life, or does it stop at...
Social life, the canteen is not open in the evening, so social life...
Do you have a pub?
There is, no, we used to have... a dreadful Burnie Inn, which then became a McDonald's, this on Manley Road, and has now been turned into some bijou flats. So there is nothing, there's no useful, accessible social space other than heading into town. So the evenings are not so obviously.
Because I'm a great believer in the eagle myth, you know, that after a hard day in the lab at in the Cavendish, walking over and having a pint of beer and relaxing and trying out fanciful hypotheses with your friends in a more relaxed way makes a lot of difference.
I agree, and actually the research students and postdocs are very good at arranging group evenings. I can't say I'm that good at going along too, but it doesn't sort of spill instantly out of the end of work in the afternoon into what's going on in the evening. And yes, I think we probably have lost something from being out in West Cambridge, but in other ways we've gained, because we have reason to stick around over lunch, so that works.
Mm. And there are other subjects, I mean, it's not just physicists who are out there. So.
Well, for the first while it was us and the vets.
A lot of exchange there.
Yeah, of course it is changing now. That there's significant parts of engineering and computer laboratory. Science building brings people from chemistry. It is changing.
Tell me something more about your own work. I mean, I think it was probably Gabriel Horn, I guess, who or Simon Schaffer, who suggested I talk to you, and they immediately drew my attention to your work on display screens, CDT or whatever the firm is called, and particularly the potentials of making new forms of screen that you can roll up and so on. Can you tell me something about that? Because I boast about it to people, saying, oh, we in Cambridge are doing this, but I have no idea what I should be saying, really.
Well, the of course, the sort of story of my having descended into doing applied physics, allegedly, is always more complex. My original interest was that it was becoming possible to get access to synthetic molecular materials, polymers turn out to be rather convenient to handle, which could be sort of simultaneously molecular but also semiconducting. And one of the best things you can do with a semiconductor, if you want to work out whether what the electrons do when they're pushed around, is to put it into a semiconductor device. Would make a transistor and hope that it works, or make a diode or something like that. So the original interest, actually, in a rather sort of grand way, was to sort of, if you like, borrow ideas about how you can assemble structures from biology and how you can then get those structures to be very functional, borrowed from the world of silicon. And that's a rather grand, obvious way of putting it. And the original structures we made were actually made purely to explore what we might find. So the transistor, which we first got working in 1988, was a tool to understand how, actually, when you start moving electrons around, unlike the case of silicon, where they travel just by themselves, the lattice of silicon atoms remains in place. If you do that with a molecular system, you disturb the positions of all the carbon atoms, and that makes a big difference to how things move. And our transistors were absolutely useless for any practical application, but they show beautiful characteristics, and we managed to get some very clean science out of that, which I was very happy about. We then were looking for something else, but chanced upon this discovery that we can get diode structures to emit light. Initially it was green light from the particular semiconducting polymer we were working with. And that was sort of obviously important, because it was obvious that we could not just make one, but make lots of them coated over a large area. So we did what I knew one had to do, which was to go and file a patent. And filing a patent is the sort of start of the process, not the end. Within a couple of years, in various ways, we'd had a lot of support from members of the Cambridge community outside the university, and we got a company organised to exploit.
Was Herman Hauser involved in
this? Herman Hauser and I overlapped as research students in the Cavendish. And Herman was not initially involved, but later has come to be a wonderful supporter of all of this.
He's raised quite a lot of venture capital.
Herman has done a lot to change the face of Cambridge. Has created a lot of opportunity.
I referred to him with a friend, a Polish man, Jan, the other day, who seemed to know you as a venture capitalist. And he said, no, he's not that. He's an industrialist. He's, you know, much more than just a raiser of money.
Ah, yes. I should use my words very carefully. Yes.
It wasn't you who said it. It was me who said it.
Yes. Well, venture capitalist is sometimes used pejoratively, but it's not just a matter of money. It's a matter of understanding what the vision for what the company might become, what the products are, what's needed to be brought along to get the right set of skills. All of that is involved in a successful venture capital. So that's not very different from being an industrialist. So what turned out over the years is that what we had thought originally would be maybe a corner of very interesting science. It turns out that these structures work very much better than we dared hope. And it's interesting, there's been a little checklist of things I had been assured by distinguished colleagues would never work. they were all wrong, every time. It's amazing what you shouldn't believe.
I've been through this with the computer revolution. We'll never get machines that can translate natural languages and so on and so on.
You just shouldn't take this too seriously. Mm. So that sort of sense of... I mean, it was never planned that it would turn out to be so useful.
Mm.
But it has turned out to be useful, so you just have to grab the opportunity and do it.
Mm. And in what way will it be useful? I mean, at what point will we notice the world changing because of this?
Well, in various ways. I mean, the problem with speaking to camera this afternoon is that maybe next year the answer will be completely different.
That's all right. It's stated.
It's stated. And the current big push is with plastic logic, which I had a role in finding in 2000. And plastic logic has found we have a very, very good technology for being able to put down huge numbers of surprisingly good transistors, which are made out of plastic, onto a sheet of plastic. And those we're using to switch a display, an electronic paper-like display, which is also flexible. So we end up with a display that feels like a sort of laminated card. At the moment the active area is A5 size. It's quite substantial, but about 1.5 million transistors in it.
Gosh.
And that, I think, is going to be what everyone has always wanted to be able to read, say, on the bus or on the train. Mm.
The quality is,
it feels like reading black on white. It has the weight of a lightweight book.
Mm.
You can bend it.
You don't turn over the pages there.
You just press a button and the page will change.
Mm.
I'm not sure what format will be finally used. But we are spending lots of other people's money building a manufacturing plant in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
To manufacture these. And by this time next year, we'll know whether it's hit the market successfully or not. But that could be big.
Mm.
There are, with Cambridge Display Technology and the light-emitting diodes, it's been hard, but we now have astonishingly good full-color displays. They're not flexible yet. There are practical reasons for that, but they're better than the crystal displays for TV. And that company has ended up being Japanese-owned. A lot of that part of the display industry is necessarily going to stay in Asia.
Hmm.
But I believe that technology will find its way into top-performing displays.
For computers?
For computers, mobile phones, where performance is absolutely to premium.
Hmm.
And then the big area which may turn out to be very important is making low-cost solar cells, where silicon is fundamentally too expensive. And what one, I think, needs is a technology which is cheap to make, cheap to deploy, maybe doesn't last forever, but by the time it's worn out, it is many times over paid for itself in terms of carbon dioxide not generated.
When you say solar cells, I know nothing. Are these things that capture
sunlight and produce electricity?
I remember reading an astonishing fact, which was that if you could get, an effective system that would capture even a small proportion of the sun's energy and cover, quite a small area of, at that time it was said the Sahara Desert, which is not perhaps where you put it, but, you could produce an enormous amount of energy.
Sunlight is essentially the only truly unlimited energy resource we have.
Mm.
You could meet the entire energy requirements of the USA today by coating the state of Kansas with not particularly efficient solar cells.
It would have to be over the whole surface.
Over the whole surface. But Kansas is a small fraction of the USA.
Mm.
That's all it would take.
And that would... I missed the crucial bit. That would be enough for the USA.
Well, the USA accounts for a quarter of world energy consumption at the moment, and that would be the hub of the USA.
Mm.
So if you could look at maps of the world with four such areas
dotted Australia.
Around Australia, Saudi Arabia, the Sahara, and that's world energy consumption. So
is this going to be possible?
Things are possible. There are sort of reality checks, and if you at the moment solar cells, which are made out of silicon, and it's a very expensive technology, it requires a lot of energy to make them. And I haven't done the calculation myself, it's very hard to check, but I'm assured that if I were to put a solar panel on my roof and leave it switched on all the time, so that every coulomb of electricity that came out of that solar cell avoided some fossil fuel generated electricity, it would take 5 years before it had paid back the carbon used to make it and put it on the roof. Which is a depressing
thought. You were going to say that. Yeah.
So you've got to bring that sort of payback time down.
But what you were saying earlier is that you're developing an alternative to silicon.
We may be able to do it. They're not good enough at the moment, but there's a significant chance that this is a route to a low enough cost, larger area technology to make a big impact on the energy.
That would be wonderful. You will be a saint. You will be our saviour.
I think sainthood would be entirely inappropriate.
You'd be simultaneously a saint and also the devil, because my wife is a second-hand bookseller, and she asked me to ask you whether your plastic books, if we can call them that, will mean the end of the book.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think technology always has unintended consequences, doesn't it? The information revolution is sort of good. The availability of one's ability to track down an out of print book now through the internet means that I now go tracking books which are out of print. Previously, I wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah,
there are always positives.
You watch more films now than we did when before television, etc., etc.
Well, as it happens, I'm very bad at watching films, because I don't seem to find myself feeling I have the time. I don't know what's going to happen. The ridiculous unavailability of most of the stuff you'd like to read, because it's out of print and unavailable, is probably going to be a thing of the past. I don't think we're going to lose our interest in being able to have books, but I don't have the same sentiment about newspapers. If I could put the content of whatever form of opinion that masquerades as fact that I choose to want to read, put that through my mobile phone onto my plastic logic display and then read it on the train or whatever, I think I'd rather do that than get sort of newsprint all over my fingers.
And throw away the paper.
And throw the paper away. I don't think I would feel badly about that.
That actually sort of answers the question, because I was wondering whether these devices would have Wi-Fi built into them. But it sounds as if you would actually have the device for capturing the book off the internet on a phone or something and then plug it in.
Well, since we all have those anyway, that would be an obvious option. And of course, technology never turns quite like what you expect it to be.
Could you actually put a sort of keyboard on these things as well?
You could do. I mean, the virtue is that what we like to read is stuff that, particularly as we get older and our eyes are less accommodating, we actually like to hold something which needs to be lightweight, a pretty accurate distance, a precise distance away from our eyes.
Yeah.
And you don't really want to have that cluttered up with a keyboard. I mean, books have been there.
No, I was thinking you could switch the keyboard on and off.
Oh, you may be able to do that, yes. The problem is that I don't think there's a universal device. I think the business of reading information has not had the attention it's deserved. We've been more concerned about being able to do everything on the same device. This may prove to be entirely outdated.
Well, watch this interview in 3 years and see how right you were. I was going to ask about, I mean, we haven't gone on with your career. Mm. You moved up through the hierarchy, assistant lecturer, all the time in Cambridge, or did you go elsewhere?
Well, I've had sabbaticals elsewhere, but I was always rather proud that I never got thrown out of Cambridge, and now I think perhaps I should have been. I've never had another job in the UK university system.
Mm.
My excuse is that I suppose getting involved, starting the two companies, was outside the university, and it provided a pretty major diversion at various times, and I think that provided a sort of diversity of experience that I don't think I would have had if I had been just mainstream in the university.
Mm. Have you spent much time, you mentioned America a little bit, have you spent any time, for example, in East Asia? Do you know what's happening in Japan and China, for instance, or India?
I've been many times to Japan because, of course, in my world, Japan has been a major player. As it happens, I have very good links with Singapore, largely because I had an absolutely brilliant research student from Singapore, who's now a professor there, and we enjoy working together.
Mm.
And I have some limited contact with India, and China I've never really gotten to grips with.
Mm.
I think the problem for me is that I can only do so much, and I suppose I'm sort of jealous of those opportunities that lead very directly to things that are going to happen in my lab. And I don't think I've fully understood what the rapidly growing Asian economies are very interesting, but they're not exactly the same thing as what I think my academic work is.
You don't have any sense of, because I spend some time in Chinese universities, and including technical universities, and ask them about the progress of computing and other subjects there, and they, each time I ask them, the time span between them catching up with Western science lessons, they seem optimistic that they're learning enough to be effective. But are they having much impact yet in, well, China in particular, on physics?
China, I think the notion that somehow Western systems are more creative than Eastern systems is last century's view. I don't believe that's true at all. And the sort of de-skilling of the West and the upskilling of the East is absolutely terrifying.
Terrifying?
Terrifying. I don't see how Western economies will cope. I don't know what we have to offer the East.
That's very interesting. I tend to agree with you. I mean, we have the English language, and a few.
Well, it's a sort of Europe as a theme park, and the English have the virtue of a different variant of a variant of American English. Not really what I want to build on. I do find it terrifying that there is so little appreciation of the virtues of technology and engineering. I think we've been through a very damaging decade where we've seen manufactured goods become absurdly cheap because they've been outsourced to principally China, and we fail to appreciate how sophisticated and complex and wonderful they are, and we have no idea how to make them now.
Yes, I've been visited Chinese factories and seen them, they are wonderful, amazing, and Japanese. Just returning to physics for a moment, it sounds as if your branch of physics is very, very alive and going very fast in interesting directions. I have talked to other physicists and people like Martin Rees and so on, and they've painted a picture of a rather more kind of post-paradigmatic shift and a plateau that we've got to the edge of the kinds of work that physicists can do because of the current state of the technologies and so on. Is that true of some branches of physics, that they are on a level since the great discoveries?
Well, physicists have been worrying about this for a very long time. Maxwell, in his inaugural lecture as the first Cambridge professor in 1873, dwelt on this for a while. He had said that it was generally put about that physics was essentially complete, and that the remaining job was to measure some fundamental constants to higher precision. Of course, he didn't agree with that proposition. It was the subject limited by our imaginations. And of course, he was right. That was just before the great quantum revolution. Only if one looks back, one would have to say that the dawn of quantum mechanics probably the very much underrated role that Maxwell played in the significance of electromagnetic theory is just astonishing. So the sense that there are discoveries from physics which will change everyday perception of reality, probably it's hard to see how that's going to happen in such a profound way as happened in the first part of the 20th century. But that, I don't think that takes the pleasure or anticipation or sense of discovery away. And maybe it's a bit of a diversion. I mean, I don't think that we used to imagine that we had to completely change the universe through our discoveries. I mean, a lot of the best science is often low-key, small-scale, just good, brilliant observation. There's plenty of that to do. And it does, of course, raise the question as to what is physics. And of course, physics isn't really a subject. I don't know. The people who spotted that we had an ozone hole over the Antarctic, I don't know whether they were physicists, but I'm sure they're physical scientists. That may have been one of the most momentous observations in recorded history. May turn out to have been that, I don't know. But the impact that good physics, or the application of the methods of physics, can make on what appear to be huge challenges with sustainable environment is probably going to be critical. I can't think of a more important time to have the tools that come from, well, not just physics, but, if you like, the numerate sciences. It's absolutely critical.
Well, you gave a very good example with light, sun conversion energy before. There would be no doubt many others. You said something about not wanting to guard your laboratory time jealously, or something like this, where rather than going away and spending time in lots of other places, which leads me to ask what I often ask about how people work. And you also mentioned this in relation to having fun and not sort of sitting at your desk with a telephone and ready to answer it all the time. How do you think and work and create?
I don't really get into the lab. That's just not possible given the role I've got in the university. So a lot of what I do is within the group, a lot of toying with ideas, planning experiments, dissecting observations and working out what didn't fly. I don't really like doing that in formal settings. I mean, it's often a sort of chance discussion that happens.
Where?
Somewhere around in the Cavendish, probably.
Around the Cavendish, yes. Yep.
But then I also done a lot of my work is sort of sits at the boundaries with a lot of it is with chemistry. I benefited from being able to get access to materials or get people to make materials which I could make, where I can see so I've had some wonderful working relationships with a great number of chemists. And there the pleasure is actually being a rank amateur at chemistry, but enjoying, but it not mattering, that where we understand that the prize is to make the connections where we, you know, both sides are fumbling to understand one another's worlds. And that, of course, tends to happen outside Cambridge, although I have some very good collaborations with people in the chemistry department here. So I think what I was alluding to earlier is that it's very easy to sort of go on the grand circuit and be grand. Either you have no visibility or else you have too much. I think, and I don't think I'm very good at it, I think one has to be very, very selfish about understanding what you're after, what's, you know, when is a visit somewhere likely to generate you know, the next good idea. Of course, it doesn't always happen to order.
And do those good ideas, I mean, the larger ideas, tend to occur when you're in conversation with people, or when you're doing experiments, or when you're in your garden, or walking, or on holiday, or...
All of the above.
All of them. Because most accounts of scientific breakthroughs, like Poincaré or Einstein or any of the rest of them, usually paint a picture of intense concentration on a problem, and then putting it on one side.
Absolutely. The moment when suddenly you have a different perspective on something can happen. Yeah, I mean, sometimes under moments of when I'm extremely stressed about something rather mundane but important that I'm worrying about, or sometimes it may be when I'm relaxed. I don't think that's part of the pattern.
Can you give any example of one of these moments?
I'm very bad at being able to recall these things, having talked in general terms. In the back of my mind, I'll turn this one over.
If you think of any, tell me when you come and visit us.
Yes.
That moment, you know, when the world suddenly... I mean, Sidney Brenner gives one or two examples, and there are a few people. It doesn't happen so much in biology, but it'd be very nice if you think of any instances.
I can remember ideas that I've had, but I'm actually not very good at remembering exactly when I had them. I think that the good idea that got the work on the transistors going probably arose on a train journey back from BP Labs in Sunbury after a sort of desultory meeting that didn't go very well. I think it did.
That's interesting. It was on the bus journey back from the south of France that Poincaré solved one of his great mathematical problems. And he remembers the second as he put his foot on the bus step, or the coach step, and it was in that second, just as Darwin solved his the second part of the theory of evolution, in the moment that the coach hit a rock. And he was thrown in the air, between being thrown in the air and landing back on the seat. He'd solved the problem. I love those.
Yes. Of course, for me, half the time, the solving the problem is what turns up when the experiment is done, and that's the way I like science to go. But then there is the formulating of what it is that one should try and do, which is not quite the same thing as a sort of eureka moment. But you can probably look back and say, well, there was a point when you sort of, when I advanced it beyond the point where everyone else knew what to do. And that's not quite as distinct as the moment when we've seen something as well.
It's just reshaping the question a little bit.
Yes. Yes. And why don't we do that experiment? Why can't we do that?
Well, this is why, I mean, I know nothing about physics. My account how you work is from Descartes, and, who seems to give this mechanistic idea of moving along a chain from the known facts to experiments. That isn't how you work.
I don't think it's that mechanistic. I think you have a sort of hunch that there are things that people don't really understand, and in some preferably large sort of green field that has not been trampled on by anyone else, and you don't quite know what you're going to find, but you know you can get to that field because you've worked out that there are things that you can measure that no one else has thought of measuring, or would have thought it would be possible to measure, or whatever. And that's probably rather imprecise, but that's not a bad way to go.
No, it's a very nice image. But the most important thing is to know where the green fields are.
It's knowing where we probably are deluding ourselves if we think we know what we're going to find.
That's even better. I always ask whether there's a lot of your life. There's your family life with your wife and your grown-up daughters. There's no doubt many other things. But is there anything large that I should have asked you about and haven't?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I might have mentioned that I... And you haven't asked me the sort of crass question of what are my hobbies, but
yes.
In some ways I felt rather distanced from laboratory work as part of everyday life, and that's part of a lot of the modern research grant holder in a British university. But it somehow feels like a sort of meta activity, that writing a good research grant proposal that gets funded is almost the same thing as discovering some good science. And I frivolously contemplate, rather than producing an autobiography or a collection of essays, and I shall publish a set of my grant proposals, since they've occupied too much of
my... What would you call it? Those that worked, or...
Yes, perhaps leave it to the reader to work out which should have been fun and which weren't.
Put in one or two spoof ones as well.
Yes, indeed, yes.
And have a prize for them.
But the sort of practical world I do enjoy. Mm. So.
What are your hobbies? I haven't asked you.
Well, hobbies, I mean, the life, home life, we've moved in recently, have a large garden, and I have for the first time a large workshop and a rather professional set of woodworking tools, and I think the sort of pleasure of doing practical things.
So Andrew Huxley is a woodworker too, I think, if I remember recall rightly.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that. I wouldn't claim that my woodworking is of the highest order, but it's good enough to be able to turn things out which are very useful. And I find that very very satisfying. Spending sort of practical skills, I think one's allowed to have.
Indeed. Well, I think that's probably a nice note to end on. So thank you very much indeed, Richard.
Thank you.